Board Game Bros.
Hello and welcome to Board Game Bros. I am Jeffrey Craig.
And I am Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life and we are board game designers in real life.
Yeah, so we've been talking about gateway games.
Yes, we have started this series, this podcast on a series where we talk about gateway games. Every episode's dedicated to a different game. And Matthew, just give me in as few words as possible, what is a gateway game?
A gateway game is a game that is easy to introduce to new players or players unfamiliar with board games, yet still holds a lot of value in terms of strategy or, you know, just fun enjoyment out of it for veteran players. It can also be said to be a gateway into other games of the genre.
So much like how St. Louis is the gateway to the West, a gateway game is a gateway into gaming.
Yes.
It gives you a small sample of what you can expect from gaming, both from actual examples being maybe a simplified version of other known strategy games, but also just being just a little fun-sized game that you can play and get to know.
Yeah.
And form a relationship with, maybe. Matthew, today we are talking about Carcassonne.
Carcassonne, a very good one.
A very great gateway game. So let's talk about Carcassonne. Do you have, or should I take
Go
this?
Ahead.
All right. Carcassonne was published in the year 2000 by Z-Man Games. It was designed by Klaus-Jürgen Reed. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. There's a umlaut over the U in Jürgen. And it is a Euro game where players indirectly compete over territories on an ever-expanding board. So, Matthew, I would like you to just take me through the rules of a game. How do you play Carcassonne?
So, at the start of the game, or really before the game starts, each player takes 7 meeples, which are little wooden figures. They look kind of like star-shaped people. They each take one of those meeples and puts them on a score track, and that will be used to represent all the players' points they acquire throughout the game. And then they take the other 6 of their meeples and keep them in front of them. Then each player sort of collectively takes the tiles, flips them all face down, except for one, which has a different color. And all those same colored tiles, they sort of shuffle together, mix around, and then create stacks of tiles for each player to draw from.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are square tiles,
yes,
right?
Yes, square tiles.
Mm-hmm. And what is on these tiles?
Well, I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
So, after all the tiles are separated and randomized, flip over that one remaining tile, and that's the starting tile. Now, that tile has 3 features on it, which are 3 out of the 4 main features that comprise Carcassonne tiles, which are, for the starting tile, it's a city, a road, and fields, with the 4th one not included on that tile being a monastery.
Okay, so what is the, what's the theme of this game? What do you do?
So yeah, in the game, each player is, they control or play as farmers, guards, just people getting by in Europe. What you do is, on each of your turns, you'll take the whatever random tile from one of the stacks you have, and you draw it, look at it, and then you place it so that it is connected to the rest of the tiles on the board in such a way that it makes no errors, I guess. So say, I don't know how else
that's
to
a very roundabout
it.
Way of saying it. Essentially, each tile has a different combination of these features that you've mentioned: the castles, the roads, the fields, and the 4th is a monastery, which only appears on a small handful of tiles. And every turn, you draw a tile and you look at the features that tile has on it, and you try to match them up on as many sides as you can. Well, not
or
necessarily
you want
that.
As many
yeah,
sides
as many sides as you want, but they have to match up. You have to match that up with other tiles on the board. So if one of the sides of your tile has a city on it, it has to be touching another city if that side were to touch another tile. Same thing can be said for roads and fields. And monasteries are more like these freestanding things. They're usually surrounded on all sides by
field. Sometimes by a road.
Yeah, sometimes they have a road coming from them. Sometimes they have a castle. But all features have to match. So if you're familiar,
there's another part.
Well, okay.
Are you done explaining the spaces?
I was going to say that if you're familiar with the puzzle games, I know I had them in school, where you received you had nine of these picture tiles, and each one has an illustration cut in half on it, each side. And the goal of the puzzle is to find the arrangement where all the pictures match up perfectly, and you'll have, you know, extras mm-hmm. going around the border. That's essentially what's happening in Carcassonne.
Yes.
There's these cut-off illustrations that you're trying to match along all edges in order to create this one unified map.
Now, however, there is, of course, the points. To get points, when you would play a tile...
And, sorry, the goal of the game is to get the most points.
Yes. Sorry. So, when you would play a tile, you can put your meeples, or one of your meeples, on one space on the tile, either the road, monastery, field, or city, that is not already being occupied by a meeple. And that includes, so if your city is connected to multiple city tiles that have cities on them in one giant city, and three tiles away in the same city, player B has a meeple on that. If you were to connect to that city, you would not be able to play a meeple on there because they already sort of own it. There is an exception to this, which is if you play a tile that is not connected to something that is already sort of owned by another meeple, and then you play your meeple on it, and then you later connect them, all the existing meeples still stay on the board, and whoever has more meeples by the time it gets scored, which I'll get to in a second, would get points.
So how do you get points?
Yes. So when you complete a feature, either by connecting two ends of a long road to like cities or towns, by completely walling a city, or by putting eight tiles in a circle around a monastery, you remove your meeple from the space that you had it on and gain points. It is 1 point for each road tile. Note that it's not each space of road, as in, like, if you had a road that did a sort of loop and it came back to the same tile it started on, it would only count that space once. Then monasteries are similar. They are 1 point for every tile surrounding it, including itself, so usually 9 points. And then cities are 2 points for every tile in the city, but if a tile has a little crest in the corner, that gives an additional 2 points for that tile. Now, there is still fields.
Mm-hmm.
And the way this works is, if a player has the most farmers in their field, or they have, you know, meeples in a field, whereas all other meeples get removed at some point, these only are counted at the end of the game when all the tiles are revealed. At the end of the game, for each field that a player has, they get 3 points for every completed city that touches that field. The game ends when all tiles have been drawn, mm-hmm. or when no legal moves can be played, which is very rare.
Mm-hmm. So we keep using this term meeple. You described what it looks like already. Yeah. This is a pretty iconic thing in the board gaming world, yeah. I would say. Usually, other games now who have these similar types of wooden figures, they're also referred to as meeples. Do you know where the term meeple comes from?
No. Is it like a mini people?
It is short for my people.
My people?
Yes. It was invented by a lady by the name of Allison Hansel, who posted the proposed name for these figures on a forum in November of 2000. So the very same year that that the game was published, Allison Hansel came up with the name Meeple, and it has stuck ever since.
In many games.
In many games. Many games now use the term meeple, even openly.
Yes.
And fans of board gaming referred to almost any small wooden figure resembling a human as a meeple.
Yep.
All right. So okay. We've talked about how to play the game. Now, we mentioned there's only six of your six meeples at the start of the game.
Per player.
And of course, you said when you start a feature or when you lay a tile down, you can choose to put your meeple on a feature mm-hmm. to score it at later points in the game. Mm-hmm. When you score it, you remove your meeple off the board, except if it's a farmer, you have to wait till the end of the game to do that. So there's a limited supply of these meeples.
Yes.
Part of the game is deciding whether it's worth it to invest a meeple into something just because eventually you might run out of meeples. But you yes. also don't want to be left with extra meeples at certain points of the game.
Oh, it should be noted, at the end of the game, unfinished features other than farms still score you points. So roads and monasteries give you the same amount of points. Monasteries in this case would be, you know, 1 point for every tile around it. Mm-hmm. And cities give you 1 point per tile and 1 point per crest on those tiles.
Mm-hmm. So half the points for a city.
Yeah. So finishing the game with meeples on the board is still okay if they're not farmers, because you're still getting points. And likewise, if you think the game, or if you see that the game's nearing the end and you have a couple meeples left in your sort of pool of meeples, you might want to get them out there because it might give you like 5 or 6 points.
Mm-hmm. So what makes Carcassonne a gateway game?
So I think one of the main things we've touched on for gateway games is that they are usually a step up from a game and a step like downward from more complicated games.
Okay.
In this case, I think one of the closest analogs that I've tried to compare Carcassonne to is to a lot of domino-based games. Things like Mexican Train, I think it's called, or Chicken Foot. I don't know if those are common domino games, but those are what we've played mm-hmm. in the past.
Yeah.
Games in which you have to spatially sort of connect tiles that have different symbols on them to indicate how they can be connected.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept of randomizing and then creating stacks is something I remember doing a lot in dominoes.
Yep. Yeah, Carcassonne has a lot of small components, very similar to like a domino game.
Mm-hmm.
But it adds this extra dimension now, because in a domino game, typically it's only end-to-end.
Yeah.
Now it's end-to-end across two axes.
Yes.
Axes.
Also, it should be mentioned that Carcassonne, similar to the previous games we've covered, has a pretty approachable theme
mm-hmm.
in that it's just like farming and building cities in medieval Europe.
Well, technically it's in France.
France?
Yes. Carcassonne is a city in France.
Ah.
Yes. And so the game is about constructing the area around the French city of Carcassonne.
Cool.
Yep. Just another fun fact about a board game.
Mm-hmm.
So gateway games, they're simple. They have a easy level of entry.
The rules are very simple in this.
You put down a piece. You could put a guy on that piece if you mm-hmm. want to. And that's about as far as it goes, as long as nobody else has their guy on that piece.
Yeah, and it doesn't take
a
lot.
Or a connecting piece.
It doesn't take a lot of like reading text or understanding what wording means, because it's just, can you line up a picture with another picture?
Yep. We're very familiar. Some of us are very familiar with these kinds of puzzle games. And it just feels right.
Yeah.
When you see a city, a giant expanding city, and you draw a chunk of that wall to finish the city, and you just slot it into place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's but it does have some strategic depth. And
of course.
Now, I've played this game a handful of times, and I don't think I've won once.
Really?
Yes. I don't think I've won a single time.
It's hard to say. I've played it a lot.
And it might be because I invest in farmlands too early. Maybe it's because I do it too late. I just want to get your take on how do you win Carcassonne, because I can't seem to figure it out quite yet.
Yeah, so farmlands are very important. And it's very important to invest in farmlands early, I think, because it's actually rather hard to connect two patches of farmland on opposite sides of a road to each other. And what that means is that if you're able to get first hold of that patch of farmland, you know, on that side of the road, then you are more likely to hold on to that as time goes on, because it's harder for other people to connect two of their separate pieces of farmland to that to overtake you. However, obviously, it's important to note that, you know, investing in farmlands means you can't get as many points throughout the rest of the game. But oftentimes I've had huge amounts of points come in at the end of the game from just making sure I have secured farmlands.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that investing in farmlands is probably one of the most important things to do in this game? Is that where the bulk of your points will come from at the end of the game?
It does give you 3 points per completed city.
Mm-hmm.
Which cities also give you quite a bit of points, and those sort of play off each other. So I think usually sort of the strategic priorities would be invest in farmlands or try to secure a farmland, and then build some short cities on top of it mm-hmm. when you can.
You know, I think, and kind of what this brings me to is an interesting part about Carcassonne, in that it is a competitive game mm-hmm. because you're trying to beat your opponents and get more points than them. But frequently during different parts of the game, you will sort of form alliances with your opponents mm-hmm. or you will meet some sort of unspoken agreement with your opponents. For instance, if you have majority control over a farmland, you want your opponents to finish their cities because mm-hmm. those give you tons of points at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some cases, it might even be beneficial for you to help your opponent finish their city.
Yeah.
In addition, like you said before, you can't put your meeple in the same connected structure as another meeple, including your own.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you could build sort of like a fractured part of a city and yeah, connect it later.
Like a satellite, yeah.
Yeah, and so when you do that, that's another reason for you to cooperate with your opponents, is if, say, one of your opponents is building a very large city that hasn't been finished yet, you can sort of attach yourself onto there. And then hopefully eventually gain control and take away those points from him.
Yeah, I think large cities are some of the most interesting parts of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes when I'm playing, I'll end up drawing a tile that is 3/4 or even entirely city on the sides. And my best choice just feels like to connect it to somebody else's city in hopes that they don't complete it by the end of the game.
Right, so that's the opposite of what we're talking yeah. about now. Instead of wanting to help your opponents by where you place your tiles, there's tons of ways to sabotage your opponents. And the biggest way to sabotage someone is, like you said, if they're working on a large city and you draw a tile, there's one tile in the game. And I believe there is only one. Yes, there's one tile in the game that has city on every single side of it. And that means that if you attach it to someone's city just on a bare edge, now they have 3 more pieces they need to obtain rather than just the one.
Exactly.
In order to finish the city, and that could stifle someone's plans. If they're unable to finish it, then you've cut that investment in half of that one meeple.
Of course, you might not want to do this to a city that's touching your farmlands, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But then, of course, like you said, there's the idea that a larger city means you can take one of the farmlands that's on the side of that city and try to weasel your way back into your own farmland to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And then another fun way I remember sabotaging people with a lot is by making it so that the player would have to make a seemingly impossible connection. So, like, if they have one wall left to complete for their city, put a road going towards that empty tile where they would need to put that wall.
Mm-hmm.
So that they would either have maybe 1-2 tiles they could possibly draw to complete it, or they just can't complete it because those tiles have already been played.
Right, because when you put a tile down, it has to match up on every single side.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for instance, the tile that you're placing would only touch one other piece, then it doesn't matter what the three other sides are, as long as you have that one covered. And if it's were to touch two pieces, then that limits the number of tiles you have access to that would slot into that spot, because now you have to match two sides, and you also have to match their specific arrangement. For instance, a city with a road on the counterclockwise edge next to it. And then, of course, like you're describing, if there were a third tile that you'd have to match with, then you're cutting it down to maybe only three tiles left in the game at any given point.
Exactly.
That could possibly go in that spot.
Now, though, with that being said, oftentimes I still, even if I'm in the lead or behind, I still can't tell who's going to win until the game's over, which I think is also a good indicator of many gateway games, is it's not quite apparent who's in the lead for most of the time.
Well, I would argue against that for Carcassonne. Really? Well, first of all, there's the only hidden information is what tile can be drawn next.
Right.
But, and that's not entirely hidden either, because technically on the back of the rules scorecard, or the rules paper that they give you in the box, they have a list of each available tile and how many there are. Anyone could just take a few minutes and take a look at that to figure out what is left for everybody. And other than that, everything else is open information. You can see where right. everyone's meeples are. You can count up the points that they have. And the points tracker is very easy and clear to read.
I guess that's true, though I often don't find myself trying to make those calculations during the game. And I feel like maybe a lot of players who would be just now getting into board gaming would find that they don't want to do those calculations either.
Sure, you don't have to do those calculations.
So I guess what I should say is, It might be better for, like, if you're just starting out, because you might not know who's going to win, which is very in line with many gateway games. But, of course, people who are sort of past that intro stage might be doing those calculations, mm-hmm. and then it's different.
But... Yeah, the resources are there to have a pretty deep understanding of how the game is played and what kinds of strategies need to be formulated in order to take the lead from whoever's winning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With that being said.
So let's talk about the game's design.
Of course.
So we mentioned that roads are worth 1 point each, cities are worth 2 points each, and the monastery is 1 point for each thing surrounding it. It's pretty obvious to tell that anything that's worth 1 point per tile is going to be easier to complete than things that are worth 2 points per tile.
Yep.
So that's a good thought, a balance on the game designer's part.
It is interesting. We did the math beforehand, and there are two more tiles with city sides than there are tiles with road sides. There's 42 tiles with a road and 44 tiles with cities.
Right, so you're less likely to draw a tile with a road than you are to draw a tile with a city. But since a tile with a road at any moment needs to only match up with one or two of their sides, and a city has the potential of needing to match up with all four sides in small cases, but most typically one or two sides, then that's sort of why it's a little harder to finish a city.
Though it should be noted that since fields completely require cities to be worth any points, having more city tiles makes sense, because then you're almost guaranteed one city to be finished at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm. And I say that it's hard to finish cities, but it's really only hard to finish big cities.
Yeah.
You can
finish a city with two tiles.
Yes. In fact, the first move of the game can earn you 4 points. Because there are some city tiles, including the opening tile, where there's only city on one side. So you just need another city that looks exactly like that on a tile, and you just butt it up against it, and you can immediately score a meeple.
Exactly.
For 4 quick points. I don't really like doing those, though.
Sometimes I like it, but it's mostly when I already have farmers on a connected field.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it's not only 4 points, it's 3 points at the end of the game.
So at the beginning of a game, if you were to draw the tile that lets you complete that city, you'd say that you'd rather complete it, but put your meeple in the farm instead.
Yes.
Okay, that's cool. I think that's an interesting strategy. I think that's a good way to start off the game.
One note that I found interesting about the game's graphic design is every different type of objective or just object in the game is color-coded. So roads are white, monasteries are reddish, fields are obviously green, and cities are a brownish yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it extremely easy to tell what any piece does at a glance. It makes it a lot easier to read the board at any stage in the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could practically squint your eyes and tell what's happening on a game of Carcassonne. Because the divisions of the cities and the roads and the fields are very obvious. And that's especially important when you're looking at the fields. Because I think that's one of the most complicated parts about the game for a beginner is seeing how the fields are shaping up. Because they can get very, very winding and sprawling, and they can connect in very odd places.
Yeah.
Without you knowing. So that's important to pay attention to while you're playing Carcassonne.
And a similar thing to being able to comprehend a board state is the idea of an emerging board state, which I think Carcassonne handles kind of well. So at the start of the game, there's one tile, and the tile you draw has four possible places you can connect it to. Now, obviously, this is going to increase over time as time goes on. And at first glance, it might seem really complicated to try to determine where to put your tile, but there's a couple factors that make it easy enough to sort of help your decision making go along smoothly as the game goes on. So emerging board state, I think that's the term, just refers to a game that starts out simple, and even though an outsider would find the game to look complex at its later stages, people who have been playing the game just see a advancement of a board state that still has a few simple choices, even though it looks like it has many more.
All right.
In this case, it's that if other people have their meeples on different areas, that already limits places where you would want to put yours, and you tend to remember those as you're playing. So if you see your opponent playing a meeple on a city, you don't, when you draw a city tile, you might not look at that because you already know that they have a meeple there. And likewise, when you draw a tile, it can only connect to any given tiles with the right orientation around it. So
your choices are limited.
Yeah, your choices are already limited.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That sort of helps the fact that you only really see what tile you're going to play at the start of your turn. You don't really get a lot of time to plan it out until it gets to your turn, but even then, it doesn't go too long on any player's given turn, so it doesn't slow the game down too much.
Mm-hmm. But you can hope for certain tiles.
You can think ahead.
One of the most fun parts of the game for me is when you're seeing this whole board formulate, and you've invested your pieces, and you're seeing your cities get bigger and bigger, and then you realize that you're down to just one more piece, and then you draw that piece.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, even if somebody else is just looking for one specific piece, for instance, maybe one that on all four sides is surrounded, there's just a blank hole in the middle of the board, finding that piece can be very satisfying.
Yeah. And even then, when you don't find it, it's still memorable.
Mm-hmm.
It's still, it's a good crushing defeat. Not necessarily a bad crushing defeat.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're getting close to the end of this episode. Not only is a gateway game a good introductory game on its level of simplicity, but it's also an introduction into other games. Can you think of any other games that are similar to Carcassonne in mechanics or strategy or theme?
That's hard to say. I honestly don't play a lot of tile-laying games like this. I know, off the top of my head, another game with similar components is Tsuro, which is a tile placement game where players are dragons, I guess, making a path throughout the sky. And the idea is each tile adds to a pathway, and you want to stay on the board while you want to direct your opponent's pieces off the board.
Mm-hmm. That sounds very similar to this.
And I know a game that came out recently that actually won the Spiel des Jahres called King Domino. King Domino.
King Domino.
Like Kingdom, mm-hmm. but King Domino.
Okay.
It's another tile placement game. I haven't gotten a chance to play it myself, though.
What about a game that we've mentioned previously on this podcast but haven't done an episode on yet? Tigris and Euphrates.
Oh, Tigris and Euphrates is a good one.
Yep, that's another tile placement game.
Though, instead of placing tiles to match features, you place tiles to strengthen connections of light-colored tiles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another one where it's very easy to look at a glance and say, this is what the board is doing.
Mm-hmm. The same mechanic of just placing tiles one after the other as the board expands is common. There's Betrayal at House on the Hill. Now, there's really no strategy. You don't get to really choose where the pieces go for the most part in that game. They just sort of appear in front of you and you have to deal with it.
But there is a good amount of suspense to it then,
mm-hmm.
when you don't know what tile is going to come out next.
By the one, Carcassonne won the Spiel des Jahres in 2001.
Okay, I thought that was true, yeah.
Yes. One other game, this is a game that I have not played, but I've seen a whole playthrough of it, and that is, Takenoko?
Takenoko?
The panda game.
The panda, yeah.
Takenoko. Right. That, uses hexagonal tiles, but it's similarly, you draw tiles and place them on a board. You're not doing this every round, though, and this is where it's a little more complicated than, Carcassonne would be, since Carcassonne is already making decisions for you. In Takenoko, you have to choose when you want to draw the tiles, choose where you place them, and choose when you want to cultivate resources from those tiles, in order to complete quests. That satisfy the Emperor of Japan and his panda and gardener.
Mm-hmm.
That game looks pretty interesting. It also has some similarities to Catan, which we mm-hmm. talked about in our first episode, Settlers of Catan.
In a lot of, there's a good amount of spatial sort of logic games that have similar but not quite the same mechanics, like a Vegas Showdown, I think it's called, is an auction game where you're building a casino, and in this case, your casino has a limited sort of amount of space it can take up, and the rooms in the casino and hotel are varying sizes. So in that case, tiles are used more as a way to both balance sort of the opportunity cost of how much space a tile takes up for what value it gives you, as well as it's used to provide sort of a spatial puzzle in that regard.
That also reminds me of Agricola and similar Agricola games, which add in worker placement, but also use this tile placement mechanic for you to manage your inventory.
Maybe so with A Feast for Odin, which is by the same designer.
Okay.
Sort of, if you've played the video game Diablo.
And follow him there for news regarding this podcast and our professional board gaming careers.
And other things.
And other things. And we should also have a website, too. That'll be fun.
That'll be really fun.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.
See you later. Thank you for listening to episode 4 of our Gateway Game series on our podcast, Board Game Bros. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and we hope you give us any feedback you might have. It is very important for us to know what our listeners like and dislike about our podcast so we can make it as great as possible going forward. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, both at BG Broscast, where you can interact with us and follow any news about our work. As always, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, and hopefully wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as on our website at bgbcast.com or on our partner's website, entertainthegeeky.com. Again, that is bgbcast.com or entertainthegeeky.com. Also, on Entertain the Geeky website, we are selling our games. Currently, we are selling Merle's Truck Stop in Maine, a one-page RPG that Jeff designed, and all profits we make from the game will help us get closer to releasing our next game and future games going forward. I will also be writing articles on the Entertain the Geeky website, focused mainly on tabletop and video games. So if you're interested in reading about some more of that, you can check that out coming forward. And next Saturday, the 26th, we will be discussing Forbidden Island, a cooperative game, the first cooperative game we've covered on this podcast so far. Once again, thank you for listening.